That's not old. It's on MeTV right now. You know, Perry Mason. I don't even know what some of the new ones are, but they're all the time. Movies made about them. TV shows made about them, but people love the courtroom drama. They love to see the legal back and forth and the digging for the truth and trying to find out the bad guy who is just so clever and how he hides everything. And then, of course, at the end of an hour, all the truth comes out and everything's hunky-dory again, right? You've caught the bad guy, he's off to jail, and life is good. Well, what we're looking at today is a courtroom drama. And it is just as masterfully told as the best Perry Mason episode, except it's real. We dig into Acts chapter 4 here, not 4, 24, Acts chapter 24. And we are going to find out, this is something that we'll point out a couple of times, Luke is a first-rate historian. The way he presents this courtroom setting is exactly what we know Roman courts look like, because the Romans left us copious notes about their courtroom proceedings. And it would happen exactly the way that Luke tells us. In many cases, there weren't jury trials for the most part. The local governor or whoever was appointed judge would have the authority to make the decision in the case. So the accusers would come and present their case before the judge, who would decide if there was enough merit to continue with a trial. If a trial was convened, they would call the accused, the defendant, in, and then the accusers would make their prosecution, and after which the defense would get his chance to defend himself. Then the judge could either delay things in order to research it further or simply make a decision. And it's exactly the format that we're going to find things following here. We know Luke was an excellent historian. That gives us confidence to know that when the Bible records these things, it is recording the truth. It's recording things accurately. And so in the areas where we can confirm it, it helps us in all of the areas where there is no other confirmation to say there's no reason to distrust what the scriptures tell us on any historical event. So if it's as mundane as a court trial, then when it says that Jesus walked on water, we have no reason to say that the writers were making things up, because they record things for us accurately. Well, we know that Paul was in the temple. He was going through the fulfillment of a vow, and some Jews saw him there, were angry at him because he's preaching the gospel of grace, and they grabbed him, they tried to mob him. They thought he had defiled the temple by bringing a Gentile in. It was a false accusation, and they started to beat him to death right there. Well, the Roman commander, a fellow named Lysias, saw what was going on, sent some troops down into the temple, separated the mob from Paul, tried to get the scoop on what was going on, but they couldn't figure it out because of the commotion, so they took Paul back into the barracks. They were going to flog Paul, but Paul says, "Hey, I'm a Roman citizen, you can't do that." So they decide to take Paul before the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish ruling body, to figure out what's going on. While Paul stood before that ruling body, the Sanhedrin got so irritated with Paul that another riot broke out, and so Lysias, the commander, was forced to withdraw Paul once again back to the barracks, where he would be protected. Then they discovered there was a plot. About 40 men had decided they were going to try to kill Paul, and they vowed never to eat or drink anything until it was accomplished. That plot, in the sovereign plan of God, was discovered, and Paul was rescued because Lysias, the commander, sent Paul with a small army from Jerusalem to Caesarea, where the governor of the region would be. He transferred his jurisdiction to Caesarea so that Felix, the governor, could handle the matter and Paul could be protected. Paul's been transferred to Caesarea, and that's where we pick up in Acts chapter 24. He's been guarded. Luke lets us know that after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus, and they laid before the governor their case against Paul. This is the pre-trial hearing. This is exactly what was supposed to happen according to Roman law. The accusers would come and present to the judge the basic facts of the case, and then the judge could decide if there was enough information to warrant a trial. I think in American judicial system, we call this a grand jury. We present evidence before a group of people to decide if there's enough evidence to lead to an indictment. And so the Jews have come down. It's only 5 days later, which if you were walking from Jerusalem to Caesarea, it takes 2 days. Paul was escorted there on horseback, and so he made it in 1 day, and by a military, which are very good at marching. And so they made the trip in a long day. We don't know if these people rode. They may have had carriages or some such thing, being the elite persons that they are. But we see they've also hired a spokesman. The term there is a rhetorician, somebody that's very good at public speaking, and it's often used to refer to a professional lawyer. So the chief priests and the elders have decided it's time to lawyer up. They've hired a man to represent them in court, and his name is Tertullius. We really don't know much about him other than that. So they lay before the governor their case against Paul. Now, verse 2 tells us that apparently the governor thinks there is enough information to warrant a trial, because it says when Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him. So now the trial has begun. The courtroom scene is in session with Felix the governor sitting as the judge. Now, a couple of things that we should note about Felix. He's a tyrant. He has been ruling over the area of Judea for about 5 years at this point, and he has ruled the Jewish people with brutal force. Any perceived slight against Roman rule has been put down with blood. We ran into a small instance of that when Paul was first arrested by the Roman commander, and the commander said, "Aren't you that Egyptian that led a rebellion?" We have reference to that event from other historical documents that a Jewish person from Egypt, had tried to coax the Jewish people into an armed rebellion against the Romans. And he led about 4,000 people in this revolt. And the Romans put that revolt down, of course, by killing off just about all of the combatants, except the Egyptian who escaped into the wilderness. And he was never heard from again, but that was how they were dealing with things. It is because of Felix that the Jewish anti-Roman sentiments are about boiling over at this point in time. Felix had been ruling over the Jews for quite a while now, so he understood them, he knew them. He knew them. That's a new word. I'm making that one up as I go. He knew them, but he hated them. He had a great disdain for the Jewish people and Jewish culture, and at every opportunity that he had, he tried to subvert it. He tried to squelch it. And so Felix is not well loved by the Jewish people, and he does not well love them. But he is sitting as the judge of this case. Now, it is up to the prosecution to present the facts of the case. The burden of proof lies on them, not on the defendant. They have to present enough evidence for the judge to be convinced that the defendant is guilty. And so here's how Tertullus, the lawyer, opens up his case against Paul. "Since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and everywhere we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly." Now you can make your own decision. What does this sound like to you? This is flattery. Absolute flattery. Because everything that he says here is patently false. Felix has sat on the throne for 5 years at this, not throne, he's not a king, he's just a governor, but he's sat in that position for 5 years now. The Jews hate him. The Jews are constantly pushing rebellions because of him. So in what sense have they enjoyed much peace because of his rulership? None. In fact, in just a couple of years from this point, even the Romans are going to decide that Felix is such a bad governor that he needs to be replaced. And they take him off the throne. Not throne. I keep saying throne. He's not a king. They take him out of his position. So this lawyer, Tertullus, is just patently, flat out lying to gain Felix's approval. Now, this was part of most Roman trials, however. Again, we know from the notes that the Romans left us that the opening statements were often full of this kind of fluff. Most excellent Felix. The whole point is to try to gain the judge to your side because he's the one that's going to decide the case. And so you want to pander to him as much as possible without committing perjury so that he'll decide in your favor. So since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. Felix didn't really make any reforms for the nation. He tried to squash the nation. But I detain you. In order to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. In no sense, from what we understand of history, in no sense was Felix a kind man. But Tertullus is playing the part of this courtroom lawyer pretty well. And he's throwing out these flatteries to try to win over Felix's affections for them. Verse 5, he's actually going to start into the actual accusations. We have found this man a plague. That gets presented in courtrooms quite a bit, doesn't it? That's an actual law, right? You're not allowed to be a plague. You're not allowed to be a scourge. The word there is just for a pest. Someone that's an annoyance, someone that causes trouble. It's a very, very vague term. He's going to get to the more specific terms, but he's trying to paint things in a very negative picture for Paul. And so the first word that's going to come out of his mouth is this insult. This man's a pest. We found this man to be a pest. How is he a pest? Well, he stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He stirs up trouble among all the Jews. Now, in this fellow's defense, there has been a lot of trouble wherever Paul was. But in every instance, who started it? It wasn't Paul. So this is sort of the old explanation of where there's smoke, there's fire. Have you ever heard this saying? Okay, that might be true, but that doesn't tell you who started the fire. Just because everywhere Paul goes, there's some trouble, doesn't mean that Paul is the cause of trouble everywhere he goes, because guess who is also everywhere Paul goes? The Jews. And we're not trying to be anti-Semitic here this morning. That's just the historical fact, that where Paul went and preached the gospel of grace, the Jewish people resisted him. And we're not trying to lead you into any kind of anti-Semitic thinking here. God still loves the Jewish people. They are still his chosen people. And I know that this congregation supports the Jewish people and wants to see their welfare. But the greatest welfare that we can see for them is that they abandon this resistance against the gospel and come to faith in Christ, their Messiah. So, the actual accusations against Paul. He stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world. And he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. That part's actually true. The sect of the Nazarenes was another term for Christians. And Paul is indeed one of the leaders. In fact, by this point, he's written several books of the New Testament, which were very quickly being gathered together and recognized as inspired scripture. That didn't take long, which we'll look at in our Forging the Sword series. But he uses a word there that is, again, designed to cast a very negative connotation on it. It's the word sect. I mean, when you think of a sect, you don't think of anything good, right? You think of divisions. You think of arguments. You think of divisiveness. You think of mean-spiritedness. And there's a reason they choose that word. Incidentally, words have meaning. That's why we use them the way we do. And when you see words chosen for specific reasons, pay attention to what people are trying to say. The sect of the Nazarenes, he even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. Here we get to an actual legal accusation. Because up until this point, there's been nothing really specific. Okay. Tertullus is, first of all, he's trying to paint Paul as a bad guy. He's a ringleader. That doesn't sound good. He's a ringleader of a sect. That really sounds negative. He's a pestilent person. He stirs up riots. Of course, that would be something serious to a Roman governor who is charged with keeping the peace. So if Paul can be shown to be stirring up riots, then we have an actual major issue. But what he's pointing to here, he tried to profane the temple, is the fact that the Romans allowed the Jewish nation the power of execution for anyone that desecrated the temple. And it was one of the few areas where Rome allowed the Jews to exercise that prerogative. In most areas, capital punishment was reserved for the Roman authorities and it wasn't given to the Jewish people. But because of the sacredness of the temple and because of the standing of the Jewish religion in the Roman legal world, they were allowed to execute somebody that profaned the temple. And so Tertullus is trying to paint this as an actual legal jurisdictional issue. If he profaned the temple, we get to punish him. He shouldn't be in court before you, Felix. Now we have to deal with a little bit of a interesting thing here. How many of you have an ESV? I preach out of the ESV. I like the translation of the ESV most of the time. How many of you have a King James or an NASB? Okay, those of you that have a King James and an NASB, you're going to look down and you're going to see verse 7. And it's going to say this. End of verse 6, actually, verse 7 and part of verse 8. We wanted to judge him according to our law, but Lysias the commander came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. A couple of you are saying, where are you reading this? Okay, here's what happened. And we are going to delve into these kinds of issues a little bit more in our series on Forging the Sword. We know that in all of the manuscripts that we have of the New Testament, some of them do have variations. And so there is a great deal of work that goes into deciding which of the variations do we most think is the original reading. And I'm not going to say it's an easy issue. 99.9% of the time, it's very easy to tell. But once in a while, you run into something like this where we say some of the manuscripts read one way and some of them read a different way. How do we know which one is the original reading? The newest, the most recent, I should say, edition of a collated Greek New Testament. It's called the Nestle-Aland text, and I think they're in the 29th edition now, has chosen to push the end of verse 6, verse 7, and the beginning of verse 8, and say, we don't think it's original. So they didn't put it in. They have some textual evidence. And what happens is, some of the early manuscripts, the ones that we know are very, very early in church history, don't have that section. But here's the problem. The vast majority of manuscripts do have it. I'm not claiming to be an expert. I'm just going to give you my 2 pence worth of opinion here. I think it should be there. I think that the manuscript evidence is pretty strong to say that was there. Can I explain how it dropped out in some of the early manuscripts? No, I can't. But it makes sense to be there. It fits the context to be there. And it has very large support from a large number of the copies that we have to say that it's part of the original. So if you're reading the ESV, I don't know if they have this down. Mine has it as a footnote at the bottom of the page. We're going to handle this text as though it should be part of the text. His argument: we caught him desecrating the temple, in which case he should be allowed to be executed by us. We seized him. Okay, now let's talk about definitions of terms. Definitions are important. The meaning of words is important. This term means we arrested him. It's a legal term. We arrested him. Did the Jews arrest Paul? They mobbed him. They tried to lynch him. They were beating him to death right outside the temple precincts. I don't know that I would call that an official arrest. There were probably some other words that they could have used here, but they want to paint it in as positive a picture for themselves as they possibly can. So he says, we seized him. And then he continues on, but we wanted to judge him according to our law, which again, if Paul desecrated the temple, they have the legal right to do, which meant execution. It didn't mean mob execution, but he's leaving that part out. But here comes the bad guy. Dun, dun, dun. Lysias, the commander, came in with much violence and took him out of our hands. You know who's the real perpetrator of injustice in this scenario? Lysias, that Roman commander of 1,000 troops, he came in and grabbed Paul out of our hands. It's his fault we're in this whole goofy scenario. We shouldn't have even had to bother you with this, Felix. We could have dealt with it ourselves, but no, it's Lysias. Now, there's something that they may not know, and that is that Lysias has already sent a letter about this to Felix. Now, given what we know about Felix and his sentiments toward the Jewish people, do you think Felix is going to side with this testimony about Lysias? That he's just this evil person that stepped in and broke down the system of justice? Or is he going to side with Lysias' own testimony about what happened? Yeah, probably he's going to go with what Lysias already wrote. He's probably going to side with his own commander. He came in with much violence, took him out of our hands. And remember back, we just preached on this a couple of weeks ago. Who was the one perpetrating the violence? It wasn't the Roman soldiers or Lysias, right? It was the mob of Jewish people, if so filled with their hatred of Paul and his gospel of grace, that they were trying to rip Paul out of the Roman soldiers' hands and tear him to pieces. So there was much violence, that part's true. But it wasn't by the hand of the Roman commander, Lysias, or his troops. And it wasn't Paul that stirred it up. Now, the ESV jumps back in here in the middle of verse 8 and says, "By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him." So what he presents here as evidence is, look, Lysias knows what happened. He came in, he stole him out of our hands. Talk to Lysias, figure out what's going on here, and you'll see it's all his fault. Well, he's already talked to Lysias in the form of this letter that Lysias sent. He knows what Lysias' testimony is on the situation. But this is the presentation of the evidence against Paul. He's a pestilent person. He stirs up riots everywhere. He's a ringleader of the Christians. And he desecrated the temple. Those are the charges. Now, some of them are serious, if they're true, especially the one about disturbing the peace. That's a serious thing in the Roman mind. Desecrating the temple, they wouldn't care much about themselves, but Roman law granted the Jews the privilege of taking care of that. Ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, the Romans don't care. Unless the Christians are a pestilent people. And that's why he uses the term sect there. So, verse 9, the Jews also joined in the charge, affirming that all these things were so. This would be the rest of the trial where the prosecution is, for witness number one, I would like to call Ananias, the high priest. Come, take the vow, sit down. Now, Ananias, can you tell us in your own words what happened that day? Yeah, Paul was a problem. He stirred up this big thing. He defiled the temple. We were trying to stone him. And so this is the rest of the trial going on where probably he's calling witnesses. I don't think what this is saying is that all of the Jews are standing around Tertullus going, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not a cheerleading mob. They wouldn't allow that kind of disorder in the courtroom. And so what's happening here is the rest of the trial. The Jews joining in the charge, affirming that these things were so. No question there. They had the whole trip from Jerusalem to Caesarea to figure out what their testimony was going to look like and what they were going to say. Now the governor, and this is one bright spot we get out of Felix actually. He doesn't jump to any conclusions right here. And in fact, he doesn't say a thing. Tertullus finishes his prosecution. And I think in our modern parlance, the lawyer would say something like, yeah, Your Honor, the prosecution rests. Now it's the defendant's turn. And so Felix, without saying a word, without tipping his hand, so to speak, of anything about what he's thinking, according to this case, he simply nods to Paul and gives him permission to speak. Okay, Paul, you're being accused. It's your turn to defend yourself. Go ahead. Now what Felix was probably expecting here is not what happens. He has a very low view of the Jewish people to begin with. He understands, I'm sure, that Tertullus just came in with this flattering and completely bogus opening statement. He's probably expecting Paul to either grovel or not have any idea what to do, because he's just this lowly Jewish guy from an uneducated society of Jewish people. So he thought. But look at how Paul responds here. Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Where's the flattery? It isn't there. What Paul says is true. Felix, you've been a judge over this nation for many years. And why does that make Paul cheerful to make a defense? Because Felix understands what's going on in Judea. He understands the Jewish mindset. He understands the Jewish customs. And he probably has some good knowledge of what's going on between Christianity and Judaism at the time. And so Paul just simply says, without any of the flattery, without any of the fluff that Tertullus gave, I'm happy to make my defense. And he uses a very technical term here. The word for defense is the legal term, apologia, for a courtroom defense. And so from right off the bat, Paul tells Felix, I'm not going to try to flatter you with a bunch of fluffy statements, but I do know what I'm doing here. I'm educated. I understand the Roman legal system. I understand my rights as a Roman citizen, and I can communicate them very, very clearly. And so right from this first sentence, Paul establishes his presence in this courtroom. I cheerfully make my defense. Here's my defense. Point number one, verse 11. You can verify that it's not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. Now, what has that got to do with the price of tea in China? Their first charge was, he's a seditious person. He stirs up riots. There was a riot in Jerusalem. It's all his fault. How much time do you need to stir up a riot? If you're really trying to overthrow the Roman government like he's been accused of, doesn't that take some time? How long's Paul been in custody? 5 days. But he says, hey, it's not been 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. And so from the first, Paul's going to make his defense that I haven't had time to stir up a sedition in Jerusalem. There hasn't been time. It's only been 12 days since I first went up to worship. I didn't go up to stir up any trouble. I went up to worship, which I'm allowed to do. And after just a few of those days, I was taken into custody. So how is it possible that I could be stirring up any trouble? Now, I want to review for you here very quickly this 12-day statement, because it's a fun one that gives us a timeline. We previously established Paul's travels to Jerusalem and said it's very likely that he arrived in Jerusalem on May 25th of AD 57. I know, it's very small print up there. Because of the itinerary that Luke gives us, traveling through the Mediterranean area, to get to Jerusalem before Pentecost, which was on May 28th, and he arrives. Probably about May 25th. He visits with James, Luke tells us, the next day. James tells him, you need to take this vow to help smooth out relations with the Jewish Christians here. So the next day, it says he takes the vow. That's day one of the vow. That's important because what does Paul mark the 12 days from? I went up to Jerusalem to worship. It's not the day he arrived in Jerusalem. I went up to Jerusalem to worship. And so I think that this Friday, May 27th, is going to be the first day that Paul's referencing. It's day one of his vow. Now, the vow was supposed to last 7 days that he took with this men. Luke tells us, and here's where we get into just a little bit of ambiguity. Luke tells us that it was near the end of the vow, near the end of the 7 days. So whether it was 5, 6, or 7 days, we can only piece together by working backwards a little bit. And so for the moment, if you'll take my word for it, I'll say that I think Tuesday, May 31st, on day 5 of the vow, is when he was mobbed. He's nearly done with the vow, but he's in the temple presenting the required offerings for that day, and the people come upon him and mob him. That same day, the Romans come down, they rescue him out of the Jewish people's hands, and they take him back to the barracks. Paul speaks to the Jewish people from the steps of the barracks, then the mob erupts again, and Paul has to be whisked back into the barracks, at which point Lysias finds out Paul's a Roman citizen. When Lysias finds out that Paul is a Roman citizen, the next day, he sets up with the Sanhedrin to have Paul stand before them to try to figure out what's going on. He goes down to the Sanhedrin. There's another riot, and Paul is taken out of the Sanhedrin and back to the barracks. Luke tells us then that the following evening, which would be that night, Jesus appears to him that evening. The next day, we discover this plot. about these 40 men who have vowed not to eat or drink anything until they can kill Paul. Anybody wonder what happened to these guys? We haven't heard about them yet, and it's been 6 days since they took the vow. They're probably getting hungry. I bet they're thirsty. So the plot is discovered, and then that evening, at 3 a.m, Lysias commands his small troop of people to carry Paul to Caesarea. So it's on Friday, June 3rd, that he is extradited to Caesarea. Then Luke tells us that it's 5 days later. So counting Friday, you say June 3rd is day one. Saturday, June 4th is two. June 5th, June 6th, June 7th is the fifth day after Paul was extradited to Caesarea. So this would be the trial before Felix. And if you start with day one of the vow, Friday, May 27th, you have May 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th, 31st, June 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, or the 12th day. Isn't that interesting how the scripture always works together that way? So Paul's point here is not to establish a timeline for us, although he does so. But it tells us it's only been 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. In fact, the way he says it, it's not even 12 full days yet. So probably he went up in the morning and when he was mobbed, but it hasn't even been 12 full days yet. So I haven't had time. I haven't had time to cause a disturbance. In verse 12, they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd. Paul wasn't even in the temple evangelizing this time. He's simply going through this procedure of these vows. So they didn't find me disputing with anyone. They didn't even find me arguing with anyone. I wasn't stirring up a ruckus, not in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city, and neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. In other words, what Paul's saying, legally speaking here, is they have not met the burden of proof. They've made a lot of accusations, but they haven't made any accusations that can actually stick. They haven't given you enough evidence to convict me. Because they can tell you, I haven't had enough time, nor did they find me anywhere stirring up problems. Verse 14, here's a brilliant legal maneuver. Paul's going to make a confession. But he's going to make a confession to something that is not illegal. He says, I do confess to you that according to the way, which they call a sect. So, okay, they told you I'm a ringleader of the way. I'm going to admit to being a follower of the way. And here's where we start to link things together with what Peter told us. Look, folks, there are going to be times where persecution is going to erupt. We can't predict them. Sometimes we can watch the ebb and flow of society and say it might be coming. But when it does happen, don't let it be because you're actually an evildoer. Let it be because you're following Christ. This is where Paul says, I haven't done anything wrong, legally speaking, but if you're going to punish me, I'm going to give you the evidence. Yes, I'm a Christian. Yes, I'm a follower of the way. He called it a sect. He called it something bad. But here's what I want to tell you about this sect, and here's how Paul brings the gospel into this courtroom scenario. This I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers. And he's establishing this precedent, which was already established back in Corinth. You remember the trial in Corinth when they stood before Gallius, the Roman governor of that region? They started making their case. Paul's a problem. He stirs up trouble. And Gallius said, look, you Jews, if this were a matter of Roman law, I'd hear you. But if it's just a matter of your internal religious beliefs, then get out of here. And at that point, Gallius established a precedent that Christianity was seen, legally speaking, as part of the Jewish faith. And the Jewish faith was tolerated by Roman law. Paul's making the same point. I have not come up with some new religion. I'm worshiping the God of my fathers, and that is permitted by Roman law. So I'm not violating any Roman law by saying this. And he's also drawing this connection. The Christianity is the fulfillment of everything that the Old Testament talks about. That if these people who are here accusing me, if they really followed the Old Testament, if they were really followers of Jehovah God, if they really believed the scriptures that they talk about so much, they'd be in the same position I am because Jesus fulfills it all. I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets. This isn't anything new. God told us He would send a Savior. God told us He would send the Messiah. God told us the Messiah would die for our sin. This isn't anything new. This isn't some blowing in by the wind new philosophy. This is ancient. It's been going on since the beginning of time. God has been revealing this to us. Verse 15, he says, I have a hope in God, which these men themselves accept. So he's lumping himself with the Jewish leaders on at least one point, and that is that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. Now, we've talked about the difference between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. The Pharisees did. The Jewish Sanhedrin was made up of both. There were some Sadducees. There were some Pharisees. But Paul's clearly going to put himself in their camp and say, they can't accuse me of wrongdoing except that I believe there's going to be a resurrection of the dead. And they believe that too, so they would be condemning themselves. What is it that Paul suffered for so often? Proclaiming that Christ is raised. Proclaiming that that historical fact has profound meaning for every person, because every person has to come to grips with the fact that Jesus is not dead. And that means that everything He told us was true. It is the final sign that confirms everything He said. If Jesus is still dead, then we can be assured that everything He told us is a farce. But He's not dead. That tomb was empty. Paul saw Him alive. He saw Him not dead. And that one indisputable fact proves that what Jesus said is true. And so if you're going to condemn me for anything, you've got to condemn me for this fact that I preach the resurrection. But these men believe in a resurrection too. They just don't believe that it happened in Jesus. Verse 16, he continues his defense. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. So this is just a very simple statement of, look, I try very hard to be a law-abiding citizen. I try very hard to make sure that I'm not violating anybody else's rights. I try not to disobey the statutes that God has given me. Now he's going to get into some specific rebuttals of their accusations. Verse 17, now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. So, actually, I didn't come up to Jerusalem to cause trouble. I came to bring help. I came to present alms. Remember the offering that he took up amongst the Gentile churches to help the poor Jewish people in Judea because there was a great famine going on. And he acknowledges that he's been gone for several years, but he says, I came up to help the people, not to stir up a sedition. And while I was doing this, they found me. Wait a second. What's the next word? Purified. They found me purified in the temple, meaning their charge about him desecrating the temple is false. They didn't find me desecrating the temple. They found me having already gone through the rituals of purification so that I can be in the temple according to the law of God. He was there presenting a vow, and the first part of which would have been some ritual sacrifices to purify himself so he could take the vow and so that he could then be in the temple to fulfill it. So he says, I was presenting offerings to my people. That's a good thing. They're not going to charge me for that. And they found me already having gone through the rituals of purification in the temple. And they didn't find me with a crowd or with a tumult. But what actually happened? He's going to start to reiterate what did happen that day. And he starts off by saying, but some Jews from Asia. And then you notice he stops and changes direction. Because I think it occurs to Paul right here. Rome had a policy that you could not accuse somebody and not be present to in person bring the charges. You couldn't do it by proxy. You had to be there. And them not being there to present the charges against Paul renders their argument null and void. And so he points this out. He says, hey, it's these Jews from Asia that started the tumult that day. Wait a second. That's the only thing they're trying to accuse me of, because Tertullus said, there was this big scuffle in the temple that Paul was the cause of. Paul says, it wasn't me, it was the Jews from Asia. Wait a second, they're not even here. They can't present a case against me. And so he points it out to Felix. They ought to be here to make the accusation should they have anything against me. In other words, this should be declared a mistrial. There's no evidence. There's no witnesses. Verse 20, he's going to allow even a possibility here, or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. The only thing the council and the high priest could bear witness to personally was what Paul said when he stood before them, before the Sanhedrin, the day after he was mobbed. And so he invites them. It's a brilliant tactical move, by the way. You want to accuse me? Go ahead, tell them something I said while I stood before you. Oh wait, I'll tell them what I said. Verse 21. Other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it's with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you this day. And Paul links it back to what he said earlier. I'm a faithful Jewish man. I believe everything our fathers taught. I believe what the Old Testament scriptures teach, that there will be a resurrection from the dead. And it has begun in Jesus. So this trial of Paul comes to a close. Felix is going to respond, and we wish he would respond a little bit better, of course, because we'd hope that he would say, oh yeah, this is easy, case dismissed, there's no evidence. But verse 22, he doesn't. He says, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, he knows who the Christians are, he put them off, saying, when Lysias the Tribune comes down, I'll decide your case. We're going to look into the aftermath of the trial here in the next few verses in the weeks to come. But I want to hold up just this section of the trial of Paul. And what Luke is trying to accomplish here as he writes this, being the good historian that he is and giving us such accurate, detailed descriptions of this Roman trial, remember Luke has a point too that he's trying to make. And I think that point is, are Christians subversive, disobedient, civil people? And the answer is no. Every time the gospel has gone to trial, there have been no evidence against it. And so Peter wants to make that point for us in the passage that we read as our scripture reading this morning. If you're going to suffer, don't let it be because you actually broke the law. We're supposed to be good citizens. We are supposed to be following the statutes that are laid down for us by our governing authorities. And it's only in instances where our governing authorities usurp God's authority over us that we are called upon to be civilly disobedient, but never in a rebellious way. Don't let us suffer as a thief or as a murderer. Let us suffer in the name of Christ. Paul gives us this great example of how to handle suffering and persecution. Is it unjust that he has to be in this position? Yes, it is. He shouldn't have to be there. He didn't do anything wrong. But you know what, folks? This happens sometimes in this life. Injustices happen. We have imperfect governments. We have imperfect people. And there might be times that our faith in Christ puts us in the position of having to defend ourselves in this way. Look at the example of Paul. Does he ever retaliate against his accusers? Never once calls them demeaning names. Never once accuses them of wrongdoing. He simply rebuts the claims, simply and effectively. And it's this great example for us. If we come to a place where we have to suffer for the name of Christ, well, let's follow that example. Let's follow Christ's example, who, it says, did not revile, didn't insult. But he bore up under persecution, knowing that it was for God's purposes. We're going to see some of the purposes that God has for Paul as these things unfold and why Paul gets to stay in prison for 2 more years. How many of you want to stay in prison for 2 years unjustly? You think, you know what? Yep, that's where I'd like to be. No. But if it would happen, could we approach it with such a faith in God that says, well, I know I didn't do anything wrong. I've been treated unjustly, but that doesn't mean that I have to be destroyed, spiritually speaking, because this is happening. Follow Paul's example. Follow Christ's example. We're going to close our time today with a call, a song that is a call to that simple charge, just to trust Jesus in every way, in everything that happens, to trust that he's in control. Whether we suffer or whether things are comfortable, we trust him. So Dan, if you would come and lead us in this final song.